Chapter 7. Unification. Physicists' relentless drive to unify their theories, to bring together the laws of the universe and encapsulate them in a single neat mathematical equation, a theory of everything, often appears to be no more than an obsession with simplicity and compactness, an effort to package up the complexity of all natural phenomena using the minimum number of underlying principles. In fact, it's subtler than that. Throughout the history of physics, the more we've discovered about the workings of nature, the more connections we've found between seemingly unconnected forces and particles, and the fewer rules and principles we've needed to explain an ever wider range of phenomena. Unification is not something we deliberately set out to achieve. It has emerged as a result of our deeper understanding of the physical world. But this success undeniably comes with a certain aesthetic appeal that drives us to keep going along the same lines. And we've been astonishingly successful at it. Mathematically, the quest to unify the laws of physics has often involved a search for abstract symmetries, patterns that hide deep truths about nature. We heard in Chapter 2 just how central symmetry has proven to be in physics, and the way it leads to laws like the conservation of energy and momentum. But I'm afraid that to truly appreciate its importance and the role that different symmetries have played in theoretical physics over the past century is somewhat beyond the remit of this short book. The hunt for a unified theory is sometimes described as an attempt to gather all the forces of nature into one framework, suggesting that there exists just one superforce, and that the different interactions we know of in nature, electromagnetism, gravitation, and the two short-range forces within the confines of atomic nuclei, are all different aspects of this single force. Physicists have so far had a good deal of success with this broad project of unification. I've already described how Newton understood that what causes the apple to fall from the tree is the same universal force, gravity, that controls the motion of the heavenly bodies across the sky. This was not at all obvious at the time, even though it might seem so to us today. Before Newton, it was believed that objects fell to the ground because everything had a tendency to move to its natural place, towards the center of the world, and that the motion of the sun, moon, planets, and stars was subject to very different principles. Newton's law of universal gravitation brings these phenomena together by stating that all masses are attracted towards each other, with a force proportional to the product of their masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. It doesn't matter whether it's an apple or the moon, the same formula governs the way both are attracted by the Earth. Another huge leap forward along the path to unification took place almost two centuries after Newton, when James Clerk Maxwell showed that electricity and magnetism are in fact different facets of the same electromagnetic force. So the electrostatic attraction between a scrap of paper and a balloon that has been rubbed on your clothing has its origin in the same electromagnetic force that attracts a paperclip towards a magnet. Almost all phenomena we see in nature are due ultimately to one or other of these two forces, gravity and electromagnetism. It was therefore natural to ask whether we can go further and bring them together in a combined theory. We've already seen that at a fundamental level, the gravitational field is nothing more than the shape of space-time itself, a revelation that was also due to a unifying idea. By combining space with time, Einstein revealed a profound truth, that only in four-dimensional space-time can all observers, however fast they're moving relative to each other, agree on the separation between two events. A decade later, his general theory of relativity gave the world a new and more accurate picture of how mass and energy cause this space-time to curve. But that wasn't enough for Einstein, who spent the most part of the next four decades of his life searching unsuccessfully for a unified theory that would combine his theory of gravity with Maxwell's electromagnetic theory. We now know that there are, in addition to gravity and electromagnetism, two other forces, the strong and weak nuclear forces, that only act over very tiny distances, but which are just as important as far as the fundamental laws of nature are concerned. And it was the unification of the electromagnetic force with one of these nuclear forces that would be the next step forward in 20th century physics. But this important advance in our understanding of the nature of the fundamental forces only came about with the evolution of quantum mechanics from a theory describing the microcosm in terms of particles and waves to one involving fields. I touched very briefly on the meaning of fields in Chapter 3 in the context of gravity and electromagnetism. We're now ready to tackle the meaning of a quantum field. Quantum field theory. I may have given you the impression that once quantum mechanics was completed almost 100 years ago, most physicists busied themselves with applying it to real problems in physics and chemistry, leaving just a few of the more philosophically minded to carry on arguing about what it all meant. To a large extent, this version of history is true. But it's also true that quantum mechanics continued to develop in sophistication throughout the first half of the last century. The basic mathematical formalism, the equations and the rules, was certainly in place by the late 1920s. But Paul Dirac soon managed to combine quantum theory with Einstein's special theory of relativity. He also brought together quantum mechanics and Maxwell's electromagnetic field theory to produce the very first quantum field theory. This developed into a powerful and very precise way of describing the electromagnetic interaction of matter with light at the quantum level. Dirac's quantum field theory describes how electrons emit and absorb photons, and how two electrons will repel each other, not by some invisible force that links them across space, but by the exchange of photons. By the 1930s, the distinction at the quantum level between the physics of particles and the physics of fields was swept away. So, in the same way that photons are the particle-like manifestations of the electromagnetic field, lumps of pure energy at the quantum scale, so too are the localized particles of matter, such as electrons and quarks, just manifestations of their more fundamental associated quantum fields. However, unlike photons and the electromagnetic field, this is not so obvious when it comes to the matter particles. The reason for this is that photons can bunch together in unlimited numbers, giving rise to what we perceive as an electromagnetic field on the macro scale, whereas matter particles like electrons and quarks are less sociable, thanks to one of the rules of quantum mechanics called the Pauli exclusion principle, which states that no two identical matter particles can occupy the same quantum state. This means we do not perceive their quantum fields so easily. By the late 1940s, mathematical problems with the description of quantum fields were finally resolved, and the theory known as quantum electrodynamics, QED, was completed. To this day, it's regarded as the most accurate theory in all of science. It's also the physical theory that explains, at a fundamental level, almost everything in the world around us, since it underpins all of chemistry and the nature of matter, from the way electronic circuits and microchips in my laptop work to the neurons firing in my brain, commanding my fingers to move across the keyboard. This is because QED is at the heart of all interactions between atoms. And yet, for all its power, QED still describes only one of the four forces of nature, electromagnetism. During the late 1950s and 60s, physicists used beautiful but complicated mathematical reasoning to combine QED with a field theory of the weak nuclear force. They showed that the weak force was, at a fundamental level, also generated by exchanged particles, equivalent to the role played by exchanged photons in describing the electromagnetic force. Today, we have a unified theory describing a single electroweak interaction that, through a process called symmetry breaking, splits into two distinct physical forces: electromagnetism, manifested by the exchange of photons, and the weak force, carried by the exchange of the W and Z bosons, which were subsequently discovered at CERN in 1983 and have since been extensively studied. The split between the two forces, the symmetry breaking, is due to another field, called the Higgs field, which gives the W and Z particles mass, while leaving the photon massless. This unification means that, at a fundamental level, the four forces of nature are reduced to just three: the electroweak force, the strong nuclear force, and gravity, which in any case is not actually a force at all, according to general relativity. You may disagree with me as to whether this has helped simplify matters. In parallel with this advance, another quantum field theory was developed to describe the strong nuclear force that holds the quarks together inside protons and neutrons. A subtlety of the strong force is that the way it acts between quarks involves a property called color charge, which deserves a brief mention. Particles that feel the electromagnetic force come in two types of electric charge, which we refer to simply as positive and negative, but which could equally well have been called left and right, black and white, or yin and yang, to indicate that they are opposite to each other. The particles that feel the strong force, quarks, come in three types of charge, named color charge, to distinguish them from electric charge. Note that the word color here is not to be taken in any way literally. The reason three types of color charge were needed, rather than just two, as with electric charge, was to explain why protons and neutrons must each contain three quarks. And the reason the analogy with color was chosen was because of the connection with the way the three different colors of light, red, blue, and green, combine to produce white light. Thus, the three quarks in a proton or a neutron each carry a different color charge, red, blue, or green, which combine to produce a particle that has to be colorless. The rule was that quarks could not exist by themselves because they carried color. They could only exist in nature by sticking together to make up colorless combinations. The other type of particles made of quarks, called mesons, contain a quark and an antiquark, which must both have the same color charge, because antiparticles always carry the opposite properties. So you could have a meson made up of a red quark of some flavor, such as up, down, or strange, together with an anti-red quark of some other flavor. The flavors of the quarks and antiquarks define the type of meson, while their color and anti-color cancel out to ensure a colorless particle. Complicated? You betcha. For this reason, the field theory of the strong nuclear force that binds quarks together became known as quantum chromodynamics, or QCD. The exchange particles between quarks are the gluons, a rather more evocative and appropriate name, I think you'll agree, than that of those weak force carrier particles, the W and Z bosons. Let us then take stock. Of the four known forces of nature, three are described by quantum field theories. The electromagnetic and the weak nuclear forces are linked together by the electroweak theory, while the strong force is described by quantum chromodynamics. A yet-to-be-fully-developed theory that connects these three forces together is known as a grand unified theory, or GUT. But until we find one, we must make do with a loose alliance of the electroweak theory and QCD, known as the standard model of particle physics. Even its most ardent defender will admit that the standard model is probably not the last word on the matter. It has survived this long in part because we have nothing better to replace it with, and in part because its predictions have so far been validated by experiments, such as the discovery of the Higgs boson in 2012, more of which later. And yet, despite this being the best description we have of three of the four forces of nature, physicists would like nothing better than to make some new discovery that conflicts with the standard model, in the hope of discovering a deeper and more accurate description of reality. But as long as the predictions of the standard model continue to be confirmed by experiments, it lives to fight another day. Of course, this whole discussion of quantum field theories emits a very important ingredient: gravity. The quest for quantum gravity. We've discovered that the description of our everyday world at the length, time, and energy scales appropriate for Newtonian physics is only an approximation, and that beneath it are more fundamental physical theories that come into their own at the extreme scales. At one end, we have quantum field theory, which has led us to the standard model of particle physics, and which accounts for three of the four known forces in the universe. At the other extreme, we have the general theory of relativity, which gives us the standard model of cosmology that encompasses the other force, gravity. This standard model of the very large is called a variety of different names, such as the concordance model, or the lambda cold dark matter model, or the Big Bang cosmology model. I'll discuss it more fully in the next chapter. Therefore, a question that physicists are often asked is why we feel it's so important, indeed whether it should even be possible, to keep going with our obsession with unification, to try to combine these two models describing entirely different scales, the quantum realm and the cosmic realm. Surely each works well in its own domain, and that should be enough for us. But again, I must stress that the purpose of physics is not simply to account for what we observe or to find some useful application based on it. Physics is about gaining the deepest and most complete understanding of reality. So this is where we're at the moment, stuck with two successful frameworks, quantum field theory and general relativity, which just don't seem to want to fit together. Indeed, they appear to have very little in common. Their mathematical structures are incompatible. And yet, this cannot be the whole story. We know that space-time reacts to the matter within it. We also know that matter, at the subatomic scale, behaves according to the rules of quantum mechanics, which must surely, in turn, affect the behavior of space-time. If an unobserved electron is in a quantum superposition of being in two or more states at once, as we know electrons can be, for example, if their quantum state is spread out over some volume of space, or in a superposition of different energies at once, then surely the space-time around this electron must reflect this fuzziness too. The problem is that general relativity just isn't quantum-y. And it's far from straightforward how we can make it so. One of the problems with this is that subatomic particles have such tiny masses that their effect on space-time is nigh impossible to measure. Still, the issue remains. How do we quantize the gravitational field? What do we need to do to bring quantum field theory and general relativity together? And if they are truly as incompatible as they seem to be, then which one of these two incredibly successful theories needs to give way to get us to quantum gravity? String theory. In the mid-1980s, a candidate theory of quantum gravity was developed. It was based on a mathematical idea called supersymmetry, which I mentioned briefly in Chapter 2. This candidate theory became known as superstring theory, and it captured the imagination of many mathematical physicists of my generation. Supersymmetry suggests a relationship between the two general types of elementary particles in the standard model: the matter particles, or fermions, quarks and electrons and their cousins, and the force carrier particles, or bosons, the photon, gluons, and the W and Z bosons. String theory had originally been proposed in the late 1960s as a theory of the strong nuclear force. But when quantum chromodynamics was developed in the 1970s and found to be so successful, string theory fell out of favor and was seen as no longer necessary. but it was soon realized that by incorporating into string theory the idea of supersymmetry, it could be reborn as a candidate for a much grander undertaking than a theory of the strong force, a theory of everything. The basic premise of supersymmetric string, or superstring theory, is that one way to unify all the forces is to add more dimensions to space beyond the three we're aware of. This idea goes back to the work of the German theoretical physicist Theodor Kaluza, who noticed just after the end of the First World War that if he solved Einstein's field equations of general relativity in five-dimensional space-time instead of four, then electromagnetism emerged out of the mathematics as vibrations in this fifth, unseen dimension. Kaluza showed his work to Einstein, who initially liked it. It seemed to do for electromagnetism what Einstein had achieved for gravitation, changing its fundamental description from a physical force to pure geometry. Yet despite this elegant way of unifying light, electromagnetism, and gravity, general relativity, most physicists, including Einstein himself, soon became skeptical of Kaluza's work, as there was no experimental evidence to suggest that this extra dimension of space existed. A few years after Kaluza's original idea, the Swedish physicist Oscar Klein suggested that the reason the fifth dimension is hidden is because it's curled up on itself, and therefore too tiny to be detected. There's a standard analogy that helps to explain what this means. From a distance, a hose looks like a one-dimensional line, but zoom in and you see that it is in fact a two-dimensional surface wrapped around into a cylinder. The second spatial dimension, the circular direction around the hose, was too small to be seen from a distance. Klein suggested that the same thing applied to Kaluza's fifth spatial dimension, which was curled up into a circle a billionth of a trillionth of the size of an atom. Despite Kaluza-Klein theory not leading to a unification of gravity and electromagnetism, it did help researchers understand the relevance of the higher dimensions in superstring theory. However, now, instead of just one hidden spatial dimension, there needed to be six, all rolled up into an impossible-to-visualize six-dimensional ball. Superstring theory thus states that there are 10 dimensions, four of space-time that we experience, plus the six hidden dimensions. To this day, many researchers looking to unify the forces of nature still work on string theory. They argue that we've come so far using successful ideas like quantum field theory and supersymmetry to understand three of the four forces, therefore surely gravity can also be tamed. They may well be right. String theory begins with the quantum mechanical properties of matter within space-time. Its central idea is that all elementary point-like particles are in fact tiny strings vibrating in the hidden dimensions. These strings would be far smaller than the scales currently probed by particle physics, and so we can only experience them as point particles. The problem that emerged by the 1990s was that it appeared there were five different versions of string theory, and no one knew which one was the correct one. So a new, even grander framework was proposed, which unified all five versions under one umbrella. This all-encompassing framework is now called M-theory, which is a supersymmetric theory with 11 rather than 10 dimensions. Yet again, it seemed, another hidden dimension was needed to help with the grand unification program. So, is that it? Is M-theory our ultimate theory of everything? Sadly, we cannot yet say. While the mathematics is elegant and powerful, we still don't know if string theory or M-theory are the right descriptions of reality. In the next chapter, I will discuss some of the outstanding issues and controversies surrounding this subject. In any case, M-theory has a worthy adversary in the race for unification. This rival theory is just as speculative, but a number of theoretical physicists see it as a purer and more sensible way of tackling unification. It's called loop quantum gravity, and it came to the fore in the last decade of the 20th century. Loop quantum gravity. Loop quantum gravity doesn't start from quantum field theory, but from the other direction, from general relativity. It assumes that space-time itself, rather than the matter it contains, is the more fundamental concept. Aesthetically, it would seem sensible to try to quantize the gravitational field, which, according to general relativity, is space-time itself. Thus, if we shrink down to small enough length scales, we should see space become grainy and discrete, in the same way that Max Planck proposed in 1900 that heat radiation ultimately comes in quantum lumps. Quantizing space suggests there should be a smallest length that cannot be further divided. However, the quanta of gravitational energy are the quanta of space itself, which means that they don't exist as lumps within space. They are lumps of space. It's thought that the tiniest unit of space, a quantum of volume, is one Planck length, or 10 to the power of minus 35 meters across. I've always enjoyed trying to find ways of describing how tiny this volume is. For example, an atomic nucleus contains as many Planck volumes inside it as there are cubic meters in the Milky Way galaxy. This discretization of space seems inevitable if we want to quantize the gravitational field, and it therefore follows that time must also be lumpy. So the smooth space and time that we experience is nothing more than a large-scale approximation of the lumpy quanta of gravity, smeared out because the individual pixels of space-time are too small for us to perceive. Loop quantum gravity contrasts dramatically with string theory, which predicts that just as the three forces covered by the Standard Model, electromagnetism and the strong and weak nuclear forces, are in fact quantum fields manifested as force-carrying particles, so too is the gravitational field mediated by a quantum particle of gravity, the graviton, a massless state of a string. In string theory, this quantum of the gravitational field exists within space-time, whereas in loop quantum gravity, it is space-time itself that is quantized. Loop quantum gravity refers to the closed paths that take you from a quantum of space via its links to adjacent quanta around in a loop and back to the starting point. The nature of these loops determines the curvature of space-time. They're not physical entities like strings. All that is real is the relationship between the loops. In a sense, loop quantum gravity is modest in its scope, but when you consider it more carefully, you begin to realize that if it is indeed the correct description of reality, then it's not so much that events take place within space and for a duration of time, but rather that the universe and everything in it, all matter and energy, is nothing more than quantum fields coexisting and superimposed onto each other. And these fields do not require space and time to exist in, since space-time is itself one of these quantum fields. In summary, we cannot yet claim to have a genuine theory of everything, nor do we understand yet how to bring quantum mechanics and general relativity together. Rather, we have candidate theories that show some promise, but which still leave many questions unanswered. Brilliant physicists have built their careers on one or the other such theory, but just as with different interpretations of quantum mechanics, there is a lot of sociology of science involved, and views on which theory shows the most promise really do depend on who you speak to. Broadly then, in the red corner, we have string theory, which is our current best stab at unifying the four forces of nature, but which, despite 3.5 decades of research, is still speculative. Some physicists claim that despite all the progress it has made, it is now reaching something of a crisis, because it hasn't delivered on its earlier promise. Indeed, it can be argued that it's not yet even a proper scientific theory, since it has not made any testable predictions. Then, in the blue corner, we have loop quantum gravity, which seems to be the most sensible way of quantizing space-time, but which does not tell us how then to combine gravity with the other three forces. Whether one or the other of these two approaches is correct, or whether we need to somehow merge the two, or even look for an entirely new theory, we still do not know. This leads us nicely to where the current outstanding problems and controversies are in fundamental physics, and what advances are likely in the coming decades.